Session number 7363, George Jameson, part 19.
A little more about the way you lived, particularly in these trenches. Was it very sordid?
Yes. Yes, it was. The trenches were an apology for trenches. Certainly they had been. We took over from the Grenadier Guards, and they were 6 feet odd, all of them, and we weren't anything like that height. So we had to first of all build up the floor of the thing in order to be able to see where we were, and the fire steps. And then the only place we could get for shelter, admittedly it was a boggy area. There was water about, dikes about and whatnot, but the only place we could get for shelter had been an excavation in the Parados, with a tin sheet over the top of it, and we crawled in there. Well, of course, militarily, it was the wrong position. The dugout should never have been facing backwards, because any shell fire or bullet fire or whatever coming over the parapet would go that way. And would land in the very places where we were sleeping. But that was all there was. I may say that we never, or very rarely, occupied them very much. If we slept in there, it was usually during the day for a rest for about an hour or so. But generally speaking, we sat about on the parapet or on the parados somewhere. At night, we were usually up and around, not doing anything. Later on, the trenches became better down in various other parts of the line I was in. When we were in the roundabout Loos, there were proper trenches, of course, properly sandbagged, and they were constantly having to be repaired as they were shelled. At night, you would go out and do some rewiring in front and that sort of thing. We seemed to work with a kind of barbed wire that was like chicken wire compared with the Germans. They had terrific barbed wire. And the job, this idea of firing, having a field batteries firing on the wire to cut it in preparation for an attack was nothing like.
Yes, as you if have described the futility of that earlier
it
on.
It would be much better to have had people crawl out with wire cutters and cut tracks through them. What the easiest way to do, and there wouldn't have been so much lashing loose ends lying about either.
Did you ever see rats in your trenches?
Rats?
Rats.
Oh, yes, on the Somme. There was so much dead about, you see, that there were rats all over the place. They used to, they didn't make themselves apparent unless you happened to disturb something, but they would often see rats about. Disappearing down some hole or other. And they must have been there in hundreds, really, because there was so much to attract them. And particularly on the Somme, and particularly when the weather got hotter. The smell wasn't very pleasant, especially if the wind was in the wrong direction. We did what we could to clean up where we could. We tried. It was more apparent at just after Loos, trying to get the dead bodies brought away. But on the Somme, it was impossible. There was so much slaughter, and over such an area that they just had to be left. As and when it was possible, parties went out at night and buried them, and there was a sort of give and take attitude with the Germans over that. They would be out burying their dead, and we would be doing the same thing, and it would be a question of tit for tat sort of thing. But, where there were places of that sort, there were rats, all right. You saw them every now and then, you disturbed them every now and then, but there must have been hundreds more where you only saw one or two. And
how about fleas? Did you get
lice was the problem. They used to lay their eggs in the seams of your clothing, you know, and you used to have to. Oh, it was a regular thing for stuff to be sent off to the baths in the rear to be debugged. And we of course, in the yeomanry, we had time very often. We used to be able to manage to improvise some form of a flat iron to heat up and iron these things, because that was the quickest way to kill them, iron the seams, you know. Gradually, of course, as our living became different, we were much more careful about it. If we could possibly be on a bit of cleaner ground, we were careful to try and keep it clean, to not to attract all these things. But we were able to send parties to the baths, and while they were in the baths, their clothing went through the hot air, whatever, and was debugged, and they picked it up at the end again.
Was it very irritating when you did have lice? Did they bite you?
Oh, yes, yes. And there was one particular kind of animal that used to get in, and particularly into places where they could be undisturbed for a bit, and burrow the heads in, and you had to get them picked off with a knife or something, you see. They were awful. And difficult to shift. But again, as you said, was there much difference in being an officer? Well, there was.
What were these differences?
Well, the differences were in the fact that you had opportunities to keep cleaner. You see, the gun team, here was the gun, sandbagged around, posted up with netting over the top, and then sandbagged around to make cubby holes for the gun team to make their living accommodation. There were no you couldn't build up above the surface. You had to go down over, and these things were excavated around guns, and of course, get a few hot bodies all sleeping in one place together and not taking their clothes off. It's a good breeding ground for that kind of stuff. And the only way to keep them clean was to send them as regularly as we could send to bath houses and get them debugged at the same time.
So when the men were living like that, where would you, as an officer, have slept?
Well, this, I suppose, in a regular battery, things might have been different. Probably the officers would detail a party and get them on digging a hole for them. But with us, as soon as the men were settling down to dig in for what they were going to do, so many of us marked out where we were going to have the hole, and we did the digging. Rather a humorous little incident turned up at when we'd gone over the ridge and were down on the plain. We'd had a job getting the battery down there because we didn't want to use the road, if you remember. One gun at a time at night, drag ropes, blasphemy, blue language. It's a wonder the Jerrys didn't see the very lights. The trees afire with all the language that went on. But they got it all good-natured fun, and we got them down without any casualties. And the miners being miners, they got dug in very rapidly. But while they were busy, we picked a spot at the rear as a communal living room where we could put our sleeping bags down and sleep, and an area where we could have the battery box and the map and to be able to work out our firing programs on. And we'd got the place down about 5 feet. A nice, fine day. And we were sitting more or less. Oh, well, no, I think we hadn't started then. We were digging this place, and the area we decided to make for it was about twice the size of that bed, you see, and it was down about 5 feet, and we were getting on quite nicely. We didn't ask the men or detail the men to dig that for us. Drew said, right, all you fellas, get on and get us a hole dug there, and we got on with it. You see, that was the attitude in a territorial battery. I don't think it would have been the same with regulars. So we were on this job, and that lovely fine day, and suddenly Jerry started to throw over a few whiz-bangs. Somebody said, oh, you come to the conclusion we're support troops or whatever, and there was just this whoosh-bang, whoosh-bang, you know, that sort of stuff. Light shells. And then we suddenly heard with them plop. Plop. Oh, God, he's mixing gas with it, you see. So, of course, drop tools, squat down in the corner and grab our gas masks. And it happened on that particular day that MacDonald was up with us, this little irate Scots skipper. And there was Balham and Lennox and I and MacDonald in that corner, and Drew was sort of scratching himself in the middle of the floor. And we got our masks on, of course, and prepared to just sit the thing out and hope it wouldn't drop something on top of our little hole. But in the meantime, everybody took cover, and the gas was pretty potent all around. And suddenly, and while this was going on, MacDonald's mask started to go in and out like a bellows, and his throat and everywhere began to get a deep purple. And suddenly he pulls this thing off and throws it on the ground. And he says, "Well, I'm not going to wear the bloody thing any longer," you see. And we were sitting in these corners just simply creased with laughter. We couldn't contain ourselves, trying to contain with the mask on and laugh at the same time. And then one of us, I forget who it would be, but one of us pulled the thing off and said, "You had the tube twisted, Mac." Nobody would tell him until it... You know, we enjoyed the joke first and told him afterwards. He, of course, he didn't take very kindly to that. He was the one who addressed Lancaster when he arrived in his field boots, done in that red polish that used to be in vogue in that World War One. I forget what they called it. It was a red polish instead of brown. I'll think of it presently. But he took one look at Lancaster coming out for stables on one morning when we were out at rest and seeing these field boots and said, "My God, bleeding piles." "Go and take the bloody things off," said Mac.
Did you have to shave in the trenches?
Yes. Oh yes, we had to shave. We had to appear clean and soldier-like. And of course, in our own interest, we preferred to do that. Every opportunity that we could, we stripped off and washed down. Little canvas buckets, water scooped up from a shell hole or wherever. We didn't use the water that was carried up. That was, took too much effort to get it there. Not drinking water sort of stuff. No, we scrounged water wherever. Wherever we could, we bathed, and wherever we were near any water, we got into it if it was available.
How about the rum ration? You mentioned earlier on the nice hot toddies you used to have. Were you given an allocation?
At the beginning, we got these stone jars of navy rum dished out, you see, and it really was potent stuff. I'd never come against anything like it. In fact, I was very green about drink altogether to begin with, because I'd been a migraine subject all my life, you see, and I never could drink very much without getting headaches. So I was a bit green about the uses of alcohol. And when we began to get this rum ration dished out to us, I'd acquired, I don't know where, a German water bottle, an egg-shaped thing, about so big, with a very nice thing, covered in khaki cloth and a very nice thing, and just
yes.
Lipped onto a belt. Says, "Well, much better than the British issue." And every time I got a rum ration, it used to go in there until I had it full, and I'd never used any. And the effect of it all was that I had a nice stock of rum when we were in the trenches in this hard, frosty, cold night.
Oh, I think you told us the story when you made the hot toddies.
Thereafter, I didn't drink rum.
But did the men continue to get it?
Oh, yes. We used to get rum brought up, these same stone jars, to the battery position. The quartermaster sergeant or his assistant at the gun line or whoever used to dish it out. They would get a rum ration every so often when the weather was bad.
Was it a good idea, do you think?
Oh, I think so. I think so. And as a matter of fact, in the case of the infantry, they very often gave them a double rum ration just before an attack, just to sort of settle their stomachs down and give them a bit of a boost. Yes, I think that happened. We didn't, of course, because, well, one, we didn't care much for rum, unless we could go back somewhere where we could make a nice punch of it, and we couldn't do it there. The second thing was that we used to buy whiskey for the mess in cases, and we used to drink whiskey.
How about cigarettes? Did you all smoke quite a lot when you could?
Yes. Most people, I think. And strangely enough, the cigarettes were things that the other ranks used to smoke incessantly. Some of our people smoked cigarettes, but in a number of cases we smoked pipes. Drew smoked a pipe, I smoked a pipe. Lennox and Sadler smoked cigarettes. It was just a matter of whoever, you see. As I told you, the powers that be decided the troops were smoking too many cigarettes, and they tried to break them off by making a free issue of pipes to the troops. And I was very pleased to see this, because they also encouraged us to start with by lashing out a certain amount of tobacco. But now the strange thing was, of course, I was smoking a pipe. I came home on leave not so very long after that, and I was standing smoking a pipe, and an APM came up to me and said, "Don't you know you're improperly dressed?" I said, "In what way?" I was by that time a battery captain, and I think he was a captain as well. But I wasn't taking any old buck from him. And I said, "In what way?" He said, "You're smoking a pipe." I said, "So what?" He said, "Don't you know it's against orders to smoke a pipe?" I said, "No." He said, "It is. It's against orders." I said, "Look, I don't know who your bloke is issuing your orders, but the bloke who's issued my orders has issued pipes to the troops for nothing, to encourage them to smoke pipes." "Ah, where's that?" I said, "France." Oh, I see. You're from France. You're on leave, are you?" I said, "Yes." Now, I said, "Don't be so precipitate next time. I know you're a Hydean, you're an official. But try and find out a little bit about your subject before you go off a half-cock." I said, "We actually in France have been encouraged to smoke pipes because the powers that be think that cigarettes are harmful."
Now, I said, "Be associated with the gas, do you think?"
"Yes, chest trouble, you see. I think that was quite a lot to do with it." And
did that catch on, do you think? Did more men...
No, it didn't. It didn't. They were committed to the fag. And in times of stress, oh, God, they'd give us a fag. You know,
where did they get the fags from? Would these have come from home in parcels?
Yes, parcels from home. And there was a certain amount of issue. And we used to buy things every now and then, you see, and dish them out to the men to give them a little bit of extra something that they wouldn't get in the ordinary way.
Did you get parcels from home?
Oh, regularly. My mother, of course, used to bake brown bread, and I used to get... Well, there was that picture of us after Neuve Chapelle there, spread out with all the parcels all split open. I used to get regular parcels. There used to be a general beat-up at the house to get the thing all lined up, wrapped up in cloth and stitched in. They weren't just paper. They were always wrapped up in cloth, and the whole thing was stitched in and the address stitched on. Generally a parcel about so big, you see. Bread, jam, cakes, all sorts of things, cigarettes, tobacco. Anything I wrote home for, there would be a whip around to try and find something.
That must have been very important for you.
Oh, it was important. We looked for the post. Very much so.
Did you have to do any censoring of
Yes.
the men's letter?
Oh, yes, that was a regular job.
What did you think of doing that?
Well, I didn't like it very much. We did used to go to our fellows and say... Of course, there was an issue of green envelopes in which you could write a letter which was not subject to censorship. Now, that struck me as being a bit foolish, in a way, because if things had to be censored, then why give them the opportunity to write quite a volume uncensored? People who are wanting to do any trouble would use those things. Mind, they were haphazardly they were subject to check, but not on the battery position, not on the unit position. Somebody might pick one out of a mail bag and open it and send her and have it read through, just as a casual checking. But we used to tell the fellows, now look here, we've got to censor letters. We don't like to read your private thoughts to somebody at home. You give me your word that that doesn't need to be censored and I'll sign it. And they used to bring their letters up and say, this is quite clean, Captain, or this is quite clean, Mr. So-and-so. You just sign it and it'll go in the bag. So we did that quite often. They put them on their word to come clean about it, and they were, is this letter purely home news, nothing that need worry us? I don't want to read it. All right? Right.
I suppose, it could be quite embarrassing if you knew people well to read them.
Well, we did know them quite well, you see.
Did you find it embarrassing and unpleasant to have to do that?
I didn't really, for this reason, that I never used to read them closely. I used to skim. You could get into the practiced habit of skimming a letter through, and you could easily pick up straight away if there was something that ought to direct your attention more carefully to it. But the general run of stuff, there were one or two quite well, well, not one or two, there were quite a few well-educated fellows in the battery. But there were quite a lot that were not so well-educated, at least not literate. And their language was fairly simple in many ways. So you could, with a very quick flick through a page, if you didn't have it, haven't been censored, you could pick up if there was something that ought to be stroked out.
What did you have to look for?
All references to troop movement, positions, names of places. That was all, really. They couldn't give any information apart from that. They didn't know anything about anything. They weren't allowed to say that an attack's coming off so-and-so. You see, we are at such and such a place, we're getting ready for such and such.
Did you ever have to write letters about bereavement when somebody had died?
Oh, yes.
Can you tell me about that?
Well, we had to get the names and the addresses of the people and... always, whoever the section commander was, always made a habit, a rule, as a matter of fact, if anybody was wounded or anything concerning anyone of his section, he would write a personal note to the parents or the husband or the wife or whatever, and outline it, and give them as much as he could of conditions and so forth. And what we'd done, it was a job you had to do. It was a job they wanted to know about, and you tried to make it as easy for them as possible. Tried to be as... Naturally, of course, there were people we knew quite well, so we were naturally sympathetic. All we wanted to try and do, as far as they were concerned, was to ease their feelings that the man hadn't suffered or he'd... I remember old Corporal Plowman on number 2 gun looking down on Sergeant Smith after this direct hit when the battle was over, and with looking down on this fellow and saying, he was always an unfortunate fellow, poor old Smithy. An understatement of the year. Kindly meant, very kindly meant. But he was a sergeant in charge of number 1 gun, but he was always slightly in trouble about one thing or another. He didn't have quite the command of his section that the others had. He didn't have quite the punch about it, and he often used to have little incidents that he couldn't deal with, and old ploughman thing. He was always a poor unfortunate fellow, poor old Smithy. And there this body was lying there with a stake driven through the side of his head. You see, the baulks of timber were things about 3x2s or 3x4s in some of the stuff. And this gun, this direct hit, had simply smashed it up and blown stuff all over the place. And they were impaled on things, you see, with the thing. And the stuff, the metal that flew about at the time, as I say, was a bit uncomfortable.